Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are enjoying the podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, leave us a five-star review, and share this episode. And we really appreciate your support as we continue to grow. So today, without further ado, we're going to be looking at what's going on in California market and get the unique perspective from cultivation. Today, our guests are a husband and wife duo who are the founders of a family-owned and operated cannabis dispensary in Humboldt County. Please welcome the founders of Kiss Canoe, Gretchen and Jason Miller. Thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Absolutely. And our in-house guest is back, New Frontier Data's Chief Knowledge Officer. Please welcome back Mr. John Cagilla.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Before we get started into the headlines, Gretchen, would you mind just giving our listeners a quick background on Kiss Canoe for those who may not be familiar with you?
Sure. We are a small craft cannabis company located in Northern California in Humboldt County, specifically in Eureka in the hills of Humboldt. We have a farm. We are vertically integrated in the legal industry in California. We have a cultivation license, distribution license.
And three dogs.
And three dogs in the background. Mailman is here.
Just going from that, I mean, okay. What are the tips of just from you guys being a husband and wife and making it work in this industry and working together?
Sure. We have, been together for 14 years now. Cannabis possibly brought us together. One of the things that brought us together, we've both been in the industry doing it together the whole time. Transferred over to the legal market together and now raising our family in California, in Eureka. We are very open about cannabis with our kids and family. We treat it kind of like alcohol. We're like, when you're an adult, you can use cannabis, but they aren't allowed on at our businesses because they're not 21 yet. So... getting back to the business side of it, we have, we're vertically integrated. We have cultivation, distribution, retail, and manufacturing licenses in California. So we control our whole supply chain. We started out initially as farmers. And so we're legacy farmers. Jason's been cultivating for a long time. And so he's our farmer. And then I'm the herbalist and I create formulas and potions and create magic with the cannabis and other herbs. I'm a herbalist as well. So we've created a product line from our cannabis. That's a beauty and wellness line. And that's available throughout California in dispensaries. And then in the last year, we had just a small space at our facility that we converted into a retail space that we offer not only Kiss Canoe Farms flower, but also our products. And then a selection of cannabis products from local people as well as throughout California. So that was a interesting time to open. We opened the week of the shutdown, I think the pandemic shutdown. So we've been surviving and we got through the year. So we feel good about that. And so it's kind of evolved from just cultivation to adding the products to seeing that we could offer them direct to the customers in our facility. So being able to sell our own products is resulted in the dispensary that is our most recent venture in Eureka.
That's amazing. Well, hopefully that when your kids do come of age, they can continue this family operated business and keep it going.
Yes.
If that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
We support their dreams. So whatever they want. But yes.
Well, I'm sure this is going to be a great opportunity even as years to come. Well, we have a lot to cover. I want to dive right in. LA Times reported California offers $100 million to rescue its struggling legal marijuana industry. So last month, the California legislature approved a $100 million plan to bolster California's legal marijuana industry, helping cannabis businesses transition from provisional license to regular license and potentially providing support to compete with the illicit market. So you all have been operating in California for 20 years or 20 plus years. How would you describe the current state of California's legal cannabis industry?
It's in its infancy, and it's definitely, it needs to grow some legs, would be my stance. Like the regulation and the whole kind of organization around the compliance and the laws has evolved a lot as we've been operating. So there's been a lot of kind of just pivoting and needing to stay aware of how the laws are changing. And I think that the state has been doing the same thing. They've been trying to figure out how to put the resources they have coming in from all the taxes that they're placing on us to good use, and how to figure out, you know, how to regulate this industry. And one of the biggest problems is that you have a lot of lawmakers and regulators who are trying to regulate something that they really don't understand. And so there's been this whole kind of overreach and this extreme kind of stance on, you know, needing to track things that are, you know, kind of as a cultivator seem very unnecessary. But I understand their kind of like fear around the psychoactive kit, you know, power of this plant, and they want to kind of see where it is and where it's going. So they're just trying to kind of figure out how to regulate it, how to regulate the licenses, and how to kind of be able to see who's not operating legally within the state. And I don't know. It's a mess still, but they're trying. So we feel that, you know, California, the market here is going to set the stage for the world in a lot of ways, for sure, in the United States. So just kind of, you know, we're excited to be a part of it in its infancy, but we're also kind of, you know, being beaten up and bruised by it a little bit as we go, because it's just, you know, it's still figuring itself out. So, and there's painful lessons that come with that.
Now you have to do it differently.
Well, John, I know you've been watching the California market closely for years. How would you describe the current state?
It's tough, but it's growing. You know, one of the questions that we long had was whether both all of the regulatory challenges and the high taxes, I mean, Californians are paying the highest taxes of any legal market, whether that was going to really keep consumers from coming into the legal market. And based on the tax revenues being raised by the state, clearly more consumers have come into this market than would have been suggested by the tax structure. The question is whether for the holdouts, for the consumers who haven't made that transition yet, whether conditions are in place yet to facilitate their transition. And I'd actually be curious in Gretchen and Jason's perspective on this. You know, is this a market that can achieve its potential, admittedly slowly, with the current regulations? Or do you think that there's going to need to be some major changes in order for this market to kind of get where it could get if things were moving more smoothly?
I think that I think it's going to be a slow but natural progression toward it, because as a consumer, you know, it's convenience, quality, and
cost.
And so, you know, as the cost, like there are high taxes on legal cannabis, but the production is exceeding the demand. And like the, you know, as supply and demand kind of finds its balance, there will be a place where prices level out. And I think, you know, it's just a lot of it's going to be about convenience and cost for everyone. So once we can kind of align the cost with the taxes and kind of make sense of it all, I think that it will be an easy transition for people, because who wouldn't want to have tested product that they can trust? And, you know, you go from a place where you're buying something that, you know, could have had God knows what sprayed on it or whatever, to a place where you have you know, transparency and test results, and it's a confidence booster for most people. So I think like eventually it's really going to like just land in that place where it's just more convenient and the cost has found its, you know, settling point where it kind of meets the black market, I guess, if you will, or the illicit market. And, you know, hopefully consumers just tend toward a safer product, I would think, in the end. So, yeah, I think there'll always be the holdouts. There'll always be, you know, the home growers and the people who have that. But it won't be the same, I don't think, in the end, because it just won't be worth doing financially like it used to be for those people. So just, I feel like it's just going to level itself out and tend toward a safer way of consuming. And it should. It really, in my mind, like cannabis should just find its place in people's lives. It's got so many uses and so many benefits that, you know, it's not for everybody, but for the people that it's for, like, they should have access to it. It should be easy and it should be affordable. So
yeah, it's kind of like alcohol, where you could get the bootlegged moonshine, but it's a lot easier to go to the corner market and grab a beer. So I feel like in the end, it will be like that.
And I think that's a really important analogy. So Heather, to your question, you know, one of the things I think that's being catalytic in California's legal market is the availability of the value-added products. I think the market would be facing a much more difficult competition against the black market if it were just flower that was available. But with the spectrum of kind of really high quality value-added products, you know, these are things that you just can't get anywhere remotely close to the same caliber in the illicit market. So when you look at the share of value-added products to flower in California relative to the rest of the country, California has the highest ratio of value-added products being sold relative to flower. Mm-hmm. And to us, that tells us that, you know, even for the consumers who may still be relying a little bit on the unregulated market for their flower, they're coming into dispensaries to buy everything that they can't get in the illicit market. And once you come into the store and you have that legal market experience, you have that high quality and selection, the delta premium that you're paying for the legal market suddenly starts to make more sense. And I think that's what's helping coerce more consumers into the legal market.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think like the hash market's an example of that here, where, you know, there's been a lot of amazing kind of leaps in the quality of the concentrates and what people are producing. And, you know, the trend I feel like is toward the legal market, because it just from, you know, that perspective of there used to be a big illicit market industry around that. And I don't see that anymore as much. Like, it's just not as prevalent because the legal market has kind of taken its share. And I think you can see the changes from, you know, that underground market just already starting to like kind of just fall away a little bit. So I don't know that it'll ever go away completely, but I think that, yeah, I just think it's going to trend toward, you know, a safer way of buying and consuming products. So
yeah, a lot of new users too that are like, oh, I heard cannabis could help, or, you know, I heard it could help with this medical issue, or a lot of them are interested in using cannabis, but most people don't want to smoke as their entry into it. So I think, like you're saying, that brings people into dispensaries because they can find tinctures and edibles and things that are a little more topicals, where you can try it and it's not quite as intense as smoking. So I think, yet, like you were saying, that brings people into the dispensaries also. So
yeah, I mean, just looking at the you know, what your brand even offers, that just all the different kind of ways of delivering it, it's not probably available for the illicit market to even tap into that, because they don't have the interest of being a real company, yeah, like you're being legal.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of education too, because people are like, wait, you put it on your skin? What? So yeah, it's a learning curve also.
Yeah. Well, as an operator, I mean, you have this great brand. How important is branding and product differentiation? How is that important as an operator?
I think as in any product, it's, well, retail product, I guess, it's important because it's the first thing. If you're going into a store and there's 100 jars of cannabis and now you can't smell it. We used to be able to, you know, smell and touch, and now you just are looking at a jar. You're judging it on the branding. If there's a story, you're, you know, it's like your initial feeling. So it's very important to be able to grab the attention on the shelf. And then beyond that, I think the branding and the story, it's very important in this new industry, because knowing your brand is so important. There's so much corporate greenwashing with marketing and saying, yeah, we're craft and women led and all these like tricky things. And it's not maybe true if you dig, you know, maybe there's not really a woman in the C level, but working at the dispensary. And so you got to really like dig in. And I've seen some large corporations advertising as craft cannabis. And you're like, what is craft? Because if they're craft, then everyone is craft. And so like really knowing your brands and supporting the legacy farmers that have been doing it, and you know, that all this work is built on, and the education and knowledge and information, it's coming from these farmers and people. So I think supporting them and the smaller brands, and just being really familiar with the brand that you're buying from, is really important and really helps the small farmers. So it's easy to get like, you know, sucked in by the pretty branding and marketing and flashy style of the large corporations. So,
well, I did some digging on your brand, and I think the name Kiskanoo has such a cool background on kind of how you got there. Would you mind sharing just kind of the background of Kiskanoo? Because I think it's just really, I mean, for someone that is, you know, you're looking at a brand and thinking about something you want to buy or experience, it has a really good story.
Sure. We actually started out as a Green Star Humboldt, and we took it to the trademark attorney, and he said, before you tell me your brand, let me just say some things that it shouldn't be, so you're not offended if it, you know, I don't want to call your baby ugly. So he was like, it can't be a place, a color, or a, what was it, a common object. And we were like, oh shit, we have the star, green, and humble. We were like, huh. And he's like, okay, well, you know, it's not the worst, but it'll just be really hard to defend, because it's hard to defend green Humboldt in a trademark battle. So we went back to the drawing board, and we had this other name, Kiskanoo, and it was from a book that I had read in my cannabis consulting classes, is the spirituality of cannabis. And the author Chris Bennett had talked about, you know, the ways all these different religions have used cannabis throughout history. And one of the stories was in ancient Sumeria, the people used the branches and leaves from the Kiskanoo tree, and they performed ceremonies and rituals with these leaves and branches. And then phonetically, it's been traced to Kanu, cannabis, hemp. So they believed it was a hemp tree in the Garden of Eden that was called the Kiskanoo tree. It was the tree of life. So the Kiskanoos are tree of life, the hemp plant from ancient Sumeria. So kind of all ties in a cool way.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's so great.
It's a bit obscure. But,
and it just so happened to be completely clean on the U.S. trademark website. And it rolls off the tongue. Yeah. And it kind of...
No, I think it's memorable. Yeah.
The other thing I love about it is it doesn't... Like, most people haven't heard it, so it doesn't call anything to mind. So we can make it what we want it to be,
yeah,
as opposed to having this, like,
you know,
idea of what it is before you hear it. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, moving on. So, of course, regulation is not the only challenge, because it's been wildfire season in California. How have you guys prepared for that?
Thoughts and prayers.
Just pray.
Pretty much. I mean, you know,
there's only so much you can do at some point, but
to be honest, like the location of our farm at the moment is in a very dense national forest, basically. Like it's surrounded by very dense forest and it is, there's not very much we can do. We can like do our clear defensible space around our cultivation areas. And we are, you know, we're partners on a farm. We have 160 acres, but we only cultivate on 10,000 square feet. So we're less than a quarter acre of cultivation at our farm. And, you know, it's very like low impact footprint and very sustainable farming practices for where we are. Back in the, you know, illicit market days, being very remote had advantages that, you know, now maybe looked at as disadvantages. But for us, a lot of it is like, this is not a job, it's our lifestyle and it's a way of life for us. So we've just kind of kept going and we're just, you know, evolving as the industry comes into being and evolves alongside us. We're kind of forced to either get on board or get out of the way. And so we're just, you know, as far as the fire season goes, it's a very scary year in California. There's, you know, been a really bad drought and the reservoirs are low and there's really not much anyone can do other than clear a little area around you and pray. Because
if you're in the wrong spot,
yeah, just, if the lightning strikes, there's nothing to stop it, really. So it's sad, but part of it.
Are you finding that the nature of California's evolving fire seasons is changing the way people are thinking about the way they grow cannabis or grow cannabis outdoors?
More the water, I would think. The drought seems to be affecting people. I feel like the fires have been happening, but this lack of water, and now people are, you know, having to get water trucked in and there's nowhere to get it from. I feel like that's a huge issue, but
also, I mean, the trend in the industry right now is out of the mountains, out of the forests and into the, you know, greenhouses in Santa Barbara and Salinas and Palm Desert, where there aren't
wildfires.
There's nothing to burn. Yeah. It's already just a desert. And yeah. And, you know, there's more and more of that kind of large scale cultivation happening in areas where there used to be cut flower farms that went bankrupt when that industry moved to South America.
And,
you know, those greenhouses were kind of defunct for 15 years and all of a sudden found a new life. And so a lot of that land is being repurposed and reactivated. And I guess that's a big part of what we see, though, when we're talking about craft cannabis versus, you know, corporate cannabis and how is it distinguished and what is it really made of. And like, you know, there's a magic in the air if you are in the right place. You know, there's clean air, clean water, different, you know, elevations create different terpene profiles. And so there is this very like nuanced quality to, you know, cannabis from different farmers. You can have the same exact clone of cannabis and give it to 40 different farmers and they're going to come back with 40 different test results. And, you know, they've been doing that, the grow off competition. We've participated in that with our farm and it's really interesting because you can see how different environments can really affect the terpene profile, the cannabinoid content and the quality of the cannabis. So, I think like, it's a weird thing. Like the trend will be away from these kind of areas where there's more danger for fires, but hopefully that craft aspect will allow operators in those areas to continue to kind of hold on to their legacy and, you know, be a part of it. Because I think if you look at like a Napa model or something, there's like, you know, large wineries versus the, you know, really small wineries. And, you know, you have, I guess, $5 Chuck and $100 a bottle Pinot. So it's like, you know, finding that balance and just trying to kind of create an identity through our brand and kind of convey our message. And, you know, really our mission isn't just to carry our 10,000 square feet of cannabis to the world. It's to like help other operators in the area to have a vehicle to reach the market through a brand that's representing that ethics and that quality of, you know, connection to the land, quality of cannabis, and kind of everything in between. So yeah, I think that that's really like the idea of what you want to create, what we want to create for Humboldt County is this path to the market and this kind of ability to hopefully land with the consumer as like, you know, delivering that consistent quality. So yeah, it's a slow process, but we're working on, you know, building that. So I think it takes time for the consumers to understand that there's more to it than just THC content and price, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, Whole Foods versus Safeway, there's a whole market for everything. We just have to kind of like wait for this market to mature.
Create it.
Yeah, create it, I guess, a little bit too. But yeah, I think cannabis consumers are already kind of alternative-minded people, I guess. And so I think there's a little bit more awareness generally among the community of cannabis consumers that kind of you're more open to, I don't know, the connection to your product, like really understanding what is in what you're consuming and what that means for the planet when you do it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like John and I, we talk about this all the time. It's so much about consumer education. You know, there's the cannabis consumer that is maybe more open-minded, like you said, but there's just so many new consumers coming in that are curious about the plant, about about CBD, you know.
Yeah.
There's so many people that want to know more.
Yeah, and it gets overwhelming, but it's very simple if you just like, just try it, go slow, see how it works for you. That's all. It's very simple.
But it does help, you know, like there is, like for CBD is a good example, like there's so many kind of snake oil products on the market that
claim to be hemp seed oil.
Yes, they claim to be CBD and they don't have any CBD in them. And like, people try them and they're like, I don't know, it didn't work for me. And so that's another aspect of our brand that we have developed is that we did launch a CBD line with our topical products and our tinctures that has allowed us to do, you know, to reach a wider market. We're selling that internationally. We have some retail relationships that are just about to launch and, you know, a few things. So We're excited about that because it allows us to reach more people. And, you know, the power of CBD as a cannabinoid is very amazing as well. I use it a lot and I find it really helps kind of keep me level and balanced. So I think everybody has a different experience with cannabinoids, but I think there, you know, CBD will find more and more of a very kind of vitamin-like role in
vitamin
people's lives,
CBD,
where it's just a daily consumed product that, you know, helps keep you balanced and level. So yeah, I think it's so exciting. That's what's so exciting about all these new consumers is like, you know, the ability to reach them and to kind of educate them and help them, you know, find the power of this plant. And yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it is great to see all the people that are like, oh, anti-cannabis, but now that it's legal and CBD you can try first, there's all these people in our lives that were very anti that now can appreciate how cannabis works for them. So it's pretty great to see.
Absolutely. Well, just kind of wrapping it up, but what would you say are like the more pressing challenges currently facing California's cannabis industry as a whole?
Changing laws, taxes, some of the testing requirements are kind of strange because they apply to like flower and topicals. Like there's a 1 year expiration date on all testing. Well, our topicals, we still have our first batch from 2015 I save, and it's still good, but you know, they've applied all those laws to all the products. So like he was saying, just a little bit of misunderstanding with the products and how they work. So some of the testing laws are kind of strange. And then banking. Because we actually got lucky with our, we have a cannabis bank, but we've had more problems with our CBD banking. That's very strange. So, like, our cannabis bank wouldn't take our CBD account. So it's like, we've had to change banks about 4 times in the last 5 years. So just things like having to run cash around and just takes all this time and isn't very secure. And now that we have a bank account, it's much better. But just a lot of those things that you don't think about in normal day-to-day business. You're like, just send a money transfer. You're like, oh, we can't. We have to drive to the bank, pick up cash, make an appointment. You know, just as time consuming and costly.
Right.
What else?
280E.
Yeah.
Federal tax laws. I don't know. There's a lot
of write-offs.
A lot of things that would help immensely if they changed as far as just running a business goes and being able to operate and, you know, write off normal business expenses and kind of just increase the margins that there are to be made in this industry, because it's very thin right now with the way the tax laws are structured. And, you know, unfortunately, the corporations have the staying power to ride through until those laws are changed. And a lot of the little guys are going to get smashed and crushed out of it because they don't. And because, you know, the margins are very, very thin right now to like survive in this industry. And they don't really want everyone to survive. Probably it's much easier to regulate, you know, 15 large operators than it is to drive all over the state and go to the middle of nowhere and investigate, you know, inspect farms and 2 hours away from town. So it really does come down to like what, you know, how the little guy survives and kind of makes it through this transition into a legal market. So I think that's going to be one of the bigger ones, is the legacy farmers staying involved, hopefully. So that's
John,
our hope.
They just covered a ton of stuff. Anything to add? There seems like there's so many challenges right now.
Yeah, I would just add, one of the reasons why some of the challenges they've addressed are so important is, you know, Gretchen and Jason are based in the epicenter of American cannabis, you know, where you have some of the most kind of connected, creative, innovative, small scale growers who have been kind of the lifeblood of America's cannabis economy for decades. And these challenges really are material. You know, when you look at these large multi-state operators, their ability to operate around the 280 regulations are one thing, but for a lot of the smaller operators who are really focused and fixated on you know, just working their businesses and operating their businesses, these regulatory hurdles are really consequential. And I think there's a discussion happening around that, but to Jason's point, the longer that both federal and state law starts creating a framework that allows you know, everyone to succeed, the more challenging it is going to be to keep some of the people who have been instrumental in getting this industry to where it is today. It's going to be really difficult for them to continue to survive without some regulatory relief. And by regulatory relief, many of them are not looking for handouts, they're just looking for a level playing field. You know, unfortunately, it has remained elusive to gain that consensus both at the state and national levels.
So well said. Well, before we wrap up, Gretchen and Jason, what are your expectations for, you know, California's cannabis market for 2021 beyond, like in 2022? Anything that you see coming up?
We're just holding on.
I think production is really gonna, you know, exceed demand. The facilities that are coming online across the state are enormous and
flooding the market.
So we're hoping that hopefully, you know, federal borders will open up and there'll be a home for, you know, California cannabis. And at that point, you know, we're really looking ahead. I don't think it's going to happen by 2022, but that's kind of where we're looking ahead to, is like when we are able to take Humboldt cannabis and, you know, our brand beyond California, even to like have a wider market to really kind of find the customers who are going to resonate with what we're doing. And so, and, you know, also, and when that happens, the tax laws should change as well. And many things will kind of like open up a little bit for our industry. And I guess we're just hoping to like ride through the next few years and make it to that place where we can, you know, then find our customers and, you know, run our family business and be successful.
Love it. John, anything to add, or what are your expectations?
Just one thing that I'm looking forward to seeing how it evolves is the role of Canna Tourism and really giving a place like Humboldt the opportunity to spotlight the craft grower. You know, there's really no reason why the cannabis industry can't replicate the phenomenal success of the wine industry and its wine tours with Napa. And, you know, there are few better places on the planet to have that kind of experience than in Humboldt. There's a few structural things that need to be worked out. One is allowing people on site to these farms and how you allow kind of that management process. And then two, just some supply chain issues. There's not enough rental cars in Humboldt County for people who are planning to drive around. So, but those are kind of details that I think, you know, some concerted thinking can be readily addressed. But I think the ability to get enthusiastic consumers to actually walk the fields, touch the plants, and get to know the people who are producing the cannabis that they're consuming completely changes the consumer brand relationship or dynamic. And I think that could be one of the things that proves or could play a really important role in both casting a spotlight on the craft or boutique farmer, but also providing broader economic growth opportunities for the region.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of tourism right at our dispensary because it's on the 101. And even through the whole pandemic, we were very surprised how many out-of-towners there were. So I think in California, the Humboldt name is a bit lost because there's, you know, California has cannabis all over. But I feel like once the state borders are open, that the Humboldt name will really have some pull behind it. So it's exciting.
Well, John, maybe we can do our company offsite there. We can do a tour.
Sign me up.
Yeah, come visit anytime again. We're happy to show you all around. And
well, thank you guys so much. I feel like we could have talked for hours with you. So thank you so much for your time and thank you for being here. And thank you to our listeners at Canna Week. Again, please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. And if you really like us, leave us a 5-star review. And thank you for joining us. And we will see you next time. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Thank you. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.